Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Chapter 8 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 8. When Ethan was called back to the farm by his father's illness, his mother gave him, for his own use, a small room behind the untenanted best parlor. Here he had nailed up shelves for his books, built himself a box sofa out of boards and a mattress, laid out his papers on the kitchen table, hung on the rough plaster wall an engraving of Abraham Lincoln and a calendar with Thoughts from the Poets, and tried with these meager properties to produce some likeness to the study of a minister who had been kind to him and lent him books when he was at Worcester. He still took refuge there in summer, but when Matty came to live at the farm he had to give her his stove, and consequently the room was uninhabitable for several months of the year. To this retreat he descended as soon as the house was quiet, and Zina's steady breathing from the bed had assured him that there was to be no sequel to the scene in the kitchen. After Zina's departure, he and Matty had stood speechless, neither seeking to approach the other. Then the girl had returned to her task of cleaning up the kitchen for the night, and he had taken his lantern and gone on his usual round outside the house. The kitchen was empty when he came back to it, but his tobacco pouch and pipe had been laid on the table, and under them was a scrap of paper torn from the back of a seedsman catalogue, on which three words were written: "Don't trouble, Ethan." Going into his cold, dark study, he placed the lantern on the table, and stooping to its light, read the message again and again. It was the first time that Matty had ever written to him, and the possession of the paper gave him a strange new sense of her nearness. Yet it deepened his anguish by reminding him that henceforth they would have no other way of communicating with each other. For the life of her smile, the warmth of her voice, only cold paper and dead words. Confused motions of rebellion stormed in him. He was too young, too strong, too full of the sap of living to submit so easily to the destruction of his hopes. Must he wear out all his years at the sight of a bitter, querulous woman? Other possibilities had been in him, possibilities sacrificed one by one to Zina's narrow-mindedness and ignorance. And what good had come of it? She was 100 times bitterer and more discontented than when he had married her. The one pleasure left her was to inflict pain on him. All the healthy instincts of self-defense rose up in him against such waste. He bundled himself into his old coonskin coat and lay down on the box sofa to think. Under his cheek he felt a hard object with strange protuberances. It was a cushion which Zina had made for him when they were engaged, the only piece of needlework he had ever seen her do. He flung it across the floor and propped his head against the wall. He knew a case of a man over the mountain, a young fellow of about his own age, who had escaped from just such a life of misery by going west with the girl he cared for. His wife had divorced him, and he had married the girl and prospered. Ethan had seen the couple the summer before at Chad's Falls, where they had come to visit relatives. They had a little girl with fair curls, who wore a gold locket and was dressed like a princess. The deserted wife had not done badly either. Her husband had given her the farm, and she had managed to sell it, and with that and the alimony she had started a lunchroom at Bettsbridge, and bloomed into activity and importance. Ethan was fired by the thought. Why should he not leave with Matty the next day, instead of letting her go alone. He would hide his valise under the seat of the sleigh, and Zina would suspect nothing till she went upstairs for her afternoon nap and found a letter on the bed. His impulses were still near the surface, and he sprang up, relit the lantern, and sat down at the table. He rummaged in the drawer for a sheet of paper, found one, and began to write. "Zina, I've done all I could for you, and I don't see as it's been any use. I don't blame you, nor do I blame myself. Maybe both of us will do better separate. I'm going to try my luck west, and you can sell the farm and mill and keep the money." His pen paused on the word, which brought home to him the relentless conditions of his lot. If he gave the farm and mill to Zina, what would be left him to start his own life with? Once in the west, he was sure of picking up work. He would not have feared to try his chance alone. But with Maddie depending on him, the case was different. And what of Zina's fate? Farm and mill were mortgaged to the limit of their value, and even if she found a purchaser, in itself an unlikely chance, it was doubtful if she could clear $1,000 on the sale. Meanwhile, how could she keep the farm going? It was only by incessant labor and personal supervision that Ethan drew a meager living from his land, and his wife, even if she were in better health than she imagined, could never carry such a burden alone. Well, she could go back to her people then, and see what they could do for her. It was the fate she was forcing on Matty. Why not let her try it herself? By the time she had discovered his whereabouts and brought suit for divorce, he would probably, wherever he was, be earning enough to pay her a sufficient alimony. And the alternative was to let Matty go forth alone, with far less hope of ultimate provision. He had scattered the contents of the table drawer in his search for a sheet of paper, and as he took up his pen, his eye fell on an old copy of the Bettsbridge Eagle. The advertising sheet was folded uppermost, and he read the seductive words, "Trips to the West, reduced rates." He drew the lantern nearer and eagerly scanned the fares. Then the paper fell from his hand, and he pushed aside his unfinished letter. A moment ago, he had wondered what he and Maddie were to live on when they reached the West. Now he saw that he had not even the money to take her there. Borrowing was out of the question. 6 months before, he had given his only security to raise funds for necessary repairs to the mill, and he knew that without security, no one at Starkfield would lend him $10. The inexorable fact closed in on him like prison warders handcuffing a convict. There was no way out. None. He was a prisoner for life. And now his one ray of light was to be extinguished. He crept back heavily to the sofa, stretching himself out with limbs so leaden that he felt as if they would never move again. Tears rose in his throat and slowly burned their way to his lids. As he lay there, the window pane that faced him, growing gradually lighter, inlaid upon the darkness a square of moon-suffused sky. A crooked tree branch crossed it, a branch of the apple tree under which, on summer evenings, he had sometimes found Matty sitting when he came up from the mill. Slowly the rim of the rainy vapors caught fire and burnt away, and a pure moon swung into the blue. Ethan, rising on his elbow, watched the landscape whiten and shape itself under the sculpture of the moon. This was the night on which he was to have taken Matty coasting, and there hung the lamp to light them. He looked out at the slopes bathed in luster, the silver-edged darkness of the woods, the spectral purple of the hills against the sky, and it seemed as though all the beauty of the night had been poured out to mock his wretchedness. He fell asleep, and when he woke, the chill of the winter dawn was in the room. He felt cold and stiff and hungry, and ashamed of being hungry. He rubbed his eyes and went to the window. A red sun stood over the gray rim of the fields, behind trees that looked black and brittle. He said to himself, "This is Matt's last day," and he tried to think what the place would be without her. As he stood there, he heard a step behind him, and she entered.
"Oh, Ethan, were you here all night?"
She looked so small and pinched in her poor dress, with the red scarf wound about her, and the cold light turning her paleness sallow, that Ethan stood before her without speaking.
"You must be frozen,"
she went on, fixing lusterless eyes on him. He drew a step nearer. "How did you know I was here?"
"Because I heard you go downstairs again after I went to bed, and I listened all night, and you didn't come up."
All his tenderness rushed to his lips. He looked at her and said, "I'll come right along and make up the kitchen fire." They went back to the kitchen, and he fetched the coal and kindlings and cleared out the stove for her, while she brought in the milk and the cold remains of the meat pie. When warmth began to radiate from the stove, and the first ray of sunlight lay on the kitchen floor, Ethan's dark thoughts melted in the mellower air. The sight of Matty going about her work, as he had seen her on so many mornings, made it seem impossible that she should ever cease to be part of the scene. He said to himself that he had doubtless exaggerated the significance of Zina's threats, and that she too, with the return of daylight, would come to a saner mood. He went up to Matty as she bent over the stove, and laid his hand on her arm. "I don't want you should trouble either," he said, looking down into her eyes with a smile. She flushed up warmly and whispered back,
"No, Ethan, I ain't going to trouble."
"I guess things'll straighten out," he added. There was no answer but a quick throb of her lids, and he went on. "She ain't said anything this morning?"
"No, I haven't seen her yet."
"Don't you take any notice when you do." With this injunction, he left her and went out to the cow barn. He saw Jotham Powell walking up the hill through the morning mist, and the familiar sight added to his growing conviction of security. As the two men were clearing out the stalls, Jotham rested on his pitchfork to say,
"Dan'l Byrne's going over to the flats today noon, and he could take Matty's trunk along and make it easier riding when I take her over in the sleigh."
Ethan looked at him blankly, and he continued,
"Miss Frome said the new girl'd be at the flats at 5, and I was to take Matty then, so that she could catch the 6 o'clock train for Stamford."
Ethan felt the blood drumming in his temples. He had to wait a moment before he could find voice to say,
"Oh, it ain't so sure about Matty's going."
"Not so," said Jotham indifferently, and they went on with their work. When they returned to the kitchen, the two women were already at breakfast. Zina had an air of unusual alertness and activity. She drank 2 cups of coffee and fed the cat with the scraps left in the pie dish. Then she rose from her seat and, walking over to the window, snipped 2 or 3 yellow leaves from the geraniums. "Aunt Martha's ain't got a faded leaf on 'em, but they pine away when they ain't cared for," she said reflectively. Then she turned to Jotham and asked, "What time do you say Dan'l Byrne'd be along?" The hired man threw a hesitating glance at Ethan.
"Round about noon," he said.
Zina turned to Matty.
"That trunk of yours is too heavy for the sleigh, and Dan'l Byrne'll be around to take it over to the flats," she said. "I'm much obliged to you, Zina," said Matty. "I'd like to go over things with you first," Zina continued in an unperturbed voice. "I know there's a huckabuck towel missing, and I can't take out what you'd done with that match safe that used to stand behind the stuffed owl in the parlor."
She went out, followed by Matty, and when the men were alone, Jotham said to his employer,
"I guess I'd better let Dan'l come round, then."
Ethan finished his usual morning tasks about the house and barn. Then he said to Jotham,
"I'm going down to Starkfield. Tell them not to wait dinner."
The passion of rebellion had broken out in him again. That which had seemed incredible in the sober light of day had really come to pass, and he was to assist, as a helpless spectator, at Matty's banishment. His manhood was humbled by the part he was compelled to play, and by the thought of what Matty must think of him. Confused impulses struggled in him as he strode along to the village. He had made up his mind to do something, but he did not know what it would be. The early mist had vanished, and the fields lay like a silver shield under the sun. It was one of those days when the glitter of winter shines through a pale haze of spring. Every yard of the road was alive with Matty's presence, and there was hardly a branch against the sky or a tangle of brambles on the bank in which some bright shred of memory was not caught. Once, in the stillness, the call of a bird in a mountain ash was so like her laughter that his heart tightened and then grew large, and all these things made him see that something must be done at once. Suddenly it occurred to him that Andrew Hale, who was a kind-hearted man, might be induced to reconsider his refusal and advance a small sum on the lumber if he were told that Zina's ill health made it necessary to hire a servant. Hale, after all, knew enough of Ethan's situation to make it possible for the latter to renew his appeal without too much loss of pride. And, moreover, how much did pride count in the ebullition of passions in his breast? The more he considered his plan, the more hopeful it seemed. If he could get Mrs. Hale's ear, he felt certain of success, and with $50 in his pocket, nothing could keep him from Matty. His first object was to reach Starkfield before Hale had started for his work. He knew the carpenter had a job down the Corbury Road and was likely to leave his house early. Ethan's long strides grew more rapid with the accelerated beat of his thoughts, and as he reached the foot of Schoolhouse Hill, he caught sight of Hale's sleigh in the distance. He hurried forward to meet it, but as it drew nearer, he saw that it was driven by the carpenter's youngest boy, and that the figure at his side, looking like a large upright cocoon in spectacles, was that of Mrs. Hale. Ethan signed to them to stop, and Mrs. Hale leaned forward, her pink wrinkles twinkling with benevolence.
"Mr. Hale? Why, yes, you'll find him down home now."
"He ain't going to his work this forenoon. He woke up with a touch of lumbago, and I just made him put on one of old Dr. Kidder's plasters, and set right up into the fire." Beaming maternally on Ethan, she bent over to add, "I only just heard from Mr. Hale about Zina's going over to Bettsbridge to see that new doctor. I'm real sorry she's feeling so bad again. I hope he thinks he can do something for her. I don't know how anybody round here's had more sickness than Zina. I always tell Mr. Hale I don't know what she'd have done if she hadn't had you to look after her, and I used to say the same thing about your mother. You've had an awful mean time, Ethan Frome." She gave him a last nod of sympathy while her son chirped to the horse, and Ethan, as she drove off, stood in the middle of the road and stared at the retreating sleigh. It was a long time since anyone had spoken to him as kindly as Mrs. Hale. Most people were either indifferent to his troubles, or disposed to think it natural that a young man of his age should have carried without repining the burden of three crippled lives. But Mrs. Hale had said, "You've had an awful mean time, Ethan Frome," and he felt less alone with his misery. If the Hales were sorry for him, they would surely respond to his appeal. He started down the road toward their house, but at the end of a few yards he pulled up sharply, the blood in his face. For the first time, in the light of the words he had just heard, he saw what he was about to do. He was planning to take advantage of the Hale sympathy to obtain money from them on false pretenses. That was a plain statement of the cloudy purpose which had driven him in headlong to Starkfield. with the sudden perception of the point to which his madness had carried him, the madness fell, and he saw his life before him as it was. He was a poor man, the husband of a sickly woman, whom his desertion would leave alone and destitute. And even if he had had the heart to desert her, he could have done so only by deceiving two kindly people who had pitied him. He turned and walked slowly back to the farm. End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 9. At the kitchen door, Daniel Byrne sat in his sleigh behind a big-boned gray, who pawed the snow and swung his long head restlessly from side to side. Ethan went into the kitchen and found his wife by the stove. Her head was wrapped in her shawl, and she was reading a book called Kidney Troubles and Their Cure, on which he had had to pay extra postage only a few days before. Zina did not move or look up when he entered, and after a moment he asked, "Where's Mattie?" Without lifting her eyes from the page, she replied, "I presume she's getting down her trunk." The blood rushed to his face. "Getting down her trunk? Alone?" "Jotham Powell's down in the woodlot, and Daniel Byrne says he daresn't leave that horse," she returned. Her husband, without stopping to hear the end of the phrase, had left the kitchen and sprung up the stairs. The door of Mattie's room was shut, and he wavered a moment on the landing. "Matt?" he said in a low voice, but there was no answer, and he put his hand on the doorknob. He had never been in her room except once, in the early summer, when he had gone there to plaster up a leak in the eaves, but he remembered exactly how everything had looked, the red and white quilt on her narrow bed, the pretty pincushion on the chest of drawers, and over it the enlarged photograph of her mother in an oxidized frame, with a bunch of dyed grasses at the back. Now these and all other tokens of her presence had vanished, and the room looked as bare and comfortless as when Zina had shown her into it on the day of her arrival. In the middle of the floor stood her trunk, and on the trunk she sat in her Sunday dress, her back turned to the door and her face in her hands. She had not heard Ethan's call because she was sobbing, and she did not hear his step till he stood close behind her and laid his hands on her shoulders. "Matt! Oh, don't! Oh, Matt!" She started up, lifting her wet face to his. "Ethan! I thought I wasn't ever going to see you again." He took her in his arms, pressing her close, and with a trembling hand smoothed away the hair from her forehead. "Not see me again? What do you mean?" she sobbed out. "Jotham said you told him we wasn't to wait dinner for you, and I thought—" "You thought I meant to cut it?" he finished for her grimly. She clung to him without answering, and he laid his lips on her hair, which was soft yet springy, like certain mosses on warm slopes, and had the faint woody fragrance of fresh sawdust in the sun. Through the door they heard Zina's voice calling out from below, "Dan'l Byrne says you better hurry up if you want him to take that trunk." They drew apart with stricken faces. Words of resistance rushed to Ethan's lips and died there. Mattie found her handkerchief and dried her eyes. Then, bending down, she took hold of a handle of the trunk. Ethan put her aside. "You let go, Matt," he ordered her. She answered, "It takes two to coax it round the corner." And submitting to this argument, he grasped the other handle, and together they maneuvered the heavy trunk out to the landing. "Now let go," he repeated. Then he shouldered the trunk and carried it down the stairs and across the passage to the kitchen. Zina, who had gone back to her seat by the stove, did not lift her head from her book as he passed. Mattie followed him out of the door, and helped him to lift the trunk into the back of the sleigh. When it was in place, they stood side by side on the doorstep, watching Daniel Byrne plunge off behind his fidgety horse. It seemed to Ethan that his heart was bound with cords which an unseen hand was tightening with every tick of the clock. Twice he opened his lips to speak to Mattie, and found no breath. At length, as she turned to re-enter the house, he laid a detaining hand on her. "I'm going to drive you over, Matt," he whispered. She murmured back, "I think Zina wants I should go with Jotham." "I'm going to drive you over," he repeated, and she went into the kitchen without answering. At dinner, Ethan could not eat. If he lifted his eyes, they rested on Zina's pinched face, and the corners of her straight lips seemed to quiver away into a smile. She ate well, declaring that the mild weather made her feel better, and pressed a second helping of beans on Jotham Powell, whose wants she generally ignored. Mattie, when the meal was over, went about her usual task of clearing the table and washing up the dishes. Zina, after feeding the cat, had returned to her rocking chair by the stove, and Jotham Powell, who always lingered last, reluctantly pushed back his chair and moved toward the door. On the threshold he turned back to say to Ethan, "What time will I come around for Mattie?" Ethan was standing near the window, mechanically filling his pipe, while he watched Mattie move to and fro. "You needn't come round. I'm driving her over myself." He saw the rise of color in Mattie's averted cheek, and the quick lifting of Zina's head. "I want you should stay here this afternoon, Ethan," his wife said. "Jotham can drive Mattie over." Mattie flung an imploring glance at him, but he repeated curtly, "I'm going to drive her over myself." Zina continued in the same even tone, "I wanted you should stay and fix up that stove in Mattie's room afore the girl gets here. It ain't been drawing right for nigh on a month now." Ethan's voice rose indignantly. "If it was good enough for Mattie, I guess it's good enough for a hired girl. That girl that's coming told me she was used to a house where they had a furnace," Zina persisted with the same monotonous mildness. "She'd better have stayed there, then," he flung back at her. And turning to Mattie, he added in a hard voice, "You be ready by 3, Matt. I've got business at Corbury." Jotham Powell had started for the barn, and Ethan strode down after him aflame with anger. The pulses in his temples throbbed, and a fog was in his eyes. He went about his task without knowing what force directed him, or whose hands and feet were fulfilling its orders. It was not until he led out the sorrel and backed him between the shafts of the sleigh that he once more became conscious of what he was doing. As he passed the bridle over the horse's head and wound the traces around the shafts, he remembered the day when he had made the same preparations in order to drive over and meet his wife's cousin at the flats. It was little more than a year ago, on just such a soft afternoon, with a feel of spring in the air. The sorrel, turning the same big ringed eye on him, nuzzled the palm of his hand in the same way, and one by one all the days between rose up and stood before him. He flung the bearskin into the sleigh, climbed to the seat, and drove up to the house. When he entered the kitchen it was empty, but Mattie's bag and shawl lay ready by the door. He went to the foot of the stairs and listened. No sound reached him from above, but presently he thought he heard someone moving about in his deserted study, and pushing open the door, he saw Mattie, in her hat and jacket, standing with her back to him near the table. She started at his approach, and turning quickly, said, "Is it time?" "What are you doing here, Matt?" he asked her. She looked at him timidly. "I was just taking a look round, that's all," she answered with a wavering smile.
They went back into the kitchen without speaking, and Ethan picked up her bag and shawl.
"Where's Zina?"
he asked.
"She went upstairs right after dinner. She said she had those shooting pains again, and didn't want to be disturbed."
"Didn't she say goodbye to you?"
"No, that was all she said."
Ethan, looking slowly about the kitchen, said to himself with a shudder that in a few hours he would be returning to it alone. Then the sense of unreality overcame him once more, and he could not bring himself to believe that Mattie stood there for the last time before him.
"Come on,"
he said almost gaily, opening the door and putting her bag into the sleigh. He sprang to his seat, and bent over to tuck the rug about her as she slipped into the place at his side.
"Now then, go long," he said,
with a shake of the reins that sent the sorrel placidly jogging down the hill.
"We got lots of time for a good ride, Matt,"
he cried, seeking her hand beneath the fur and pressing it into his. His face tingled, and he felt dizzy, as if he had stopped in at the Starkfield Saloon on a 0 day for a drink. At the gate, instead of making for Starkfield, he turned the sorrel to the right, up the Bettsbridge Road. Mattie sat silent, giving no sign of surprise, but after a moment she said,
"Are you going round by Shadow Pond?"
He laughed and answered,
"I knew you'd know."
She drew closer under the bearskin, so that, looking sideways around his coat sleeve, he could just catch the tip of her nose and a blown brown wave of hair. They drove slowly up the road between fields glistening under the pale sun, and then bent to the right down a lane edged with spruce and larch. Ahead of them, a long way off, a range of hills stained by mottlings of black forest flowed away in round white curves against the sky. The lane passed into a pine wood with boles reddening in the afternoon sun and delicate blue shadows on the snow. As they entered it, the breeze fell, and a warm stillness seemed to drop from the branches with the dropping needles. Here the snow was so pure that the tiny tracks of wood animals had left on it intricate lace-like patterns, and the bluish cones caught in its surface stood out like ornaments of bronze. Ethan drove on in silence till they reached a part of the wood where the pines were more widely spaced. Then he drew up and helped Mattie get out of the sleigh. They passed between the aromatic trunks, the snow breaking crisply under their feet, till they came to a small sheet of water with steep wooded sides. Across its frozen surface, from the farther bank, a single hill rising against the western sun threw the long conical shadow which gave the lake its name. It was a shy, secret spot, full of the same dumb melancholy that Ethan felt in his heart. He looked up and down the little pebbly beach till his eye lit on a fallen tree trunk half submerged in snow.
"That's where we sat at the picnic," he reminded her.
The entertainment of which he spoke was one of the few that they had taken part in together, a church picnic which, on a long afternoon of the preceding summer, had filled the retired place with merrymaking. Mattie had begged him to go with her, but he had refused. Then, toward sunset, coming down from the mountain where he had been felling timber, he had been caught by some strayed revelers and drawn into the group by the lake, where Mattie, encircled by facetious youths and bright as a blackberry under her spreading hat, was brewing coffee over a gypsy fire. He remembered the shyness he had felt at approaching her in his uncouth clothes, and then the lighting up of her face and the way she had broken through the group to come to him with a cup in her hand. They had sat for a few minutes on the fallen log by the pond, and she had missed her gold locket and set the young man searching for it, and it was Ethan who had spied it in the moss. That was all, but all their intercourse had been made up of just such inarticulate flashes when they seemed to come suddenly upon happiness as if they had surprised a butterfly in the winter woods. "It was right there I found your locket," he said, pushing his foot into a dense tuft of blueberry bushes.
"I never saw anybody with such sharp eyes," she answered.
She sat down on the tree trunk in the sun, and he sat down beside her.
"You were as pretty as a picture in that pink hat," he said.
She laughed with pleasure.
"Oh, I guess it was the hat," she rejoined.
They had never before avowed their inclination so openly, and Ethan, for a moment, had the illusion that he was a free man, wooing the girl he meant to marry. He looked at her hair, and longed to touch it again, and to tell her that it smelt of the woods, but he had never learned to say such things. Suddenly she rose to her feet and said, "We mustn't stay here any longer." He continued to gaze at her vaguely, only half roused from his dream.
"There's plenty of time," he answered.
They stood looking at each other, as if the eyes of each were straining to absorb and hold fast the other's image. There were things he had to say to her before they parted, but he could not say them in that place of summer memories, and he turned and followed her in silence to the sleigh. As they drove away, the sun sank behind the hill, and the pine boles turned from red to gray. By a devious track between the fields, they wound back to the Starkfield road. Under the open sky, the light was still clear, with a reflection of cold red on the eastern hills. The clumps of trees in the snow seemed to draw together in ruffled lumps, like birds with their heads under their wings, and the sky, as it paled, rose higher, leaving the earth more alone. As they turned into the Starkfield road, Ethan said, "Matt, what do you mean to do?" She did not answer at once, but at length she said, "I'll try to get a place in a store."
"You know you can't do it. The bad air and the standing all day nearly killed you before."
"I'm a lot stronger than I was before I came to Starkfield."
"And now you're going to throw away all the good it's done you."
There seemed to be no answer to this, and again they drove on for a while without speaking. With every yard of the way, some spot where they had stood and laughed together or been silent clutched at Ethan and dragged him back.
"Isn't there any of your father's folks could help you?"
"There isn't any of 'em I'd ask."
He lowered his voice to say,
"You know there's nothing I wouldn't do for you if I could."
"I know there isn't,
but I can't."
She was silent, but he felt a slight tremor in the shoulder against his.
"Oh, Matt," he broke out, "if I could have gone with you now, I'd have done it."
She turned to him, pulling a scrap of paper from her breast.
"Ethan, I found this," she stammered.
Even in the failing light, he saw it was the letter to his wife that he had begun the night before and forgotten to destroy. Through his astonishment there ran a fierce thrill of joy.
"Matt," he cried, "if I could have done it, would you?"
"Oh, Ethan, Ethan, what's the use?"
With a sudden movement, she tore the letter in shreds and sent them fluttering off into the snow.
"Tell me, Matt, tell me,"
he adjured her. She was silent for a moment. Then she said, in such a low tone that he had to stoop his head to hear her,
"I used to think of it sometimes, summer nights, when the moon was so bright I couldn't sleep."
His heart reeled with the sweetness of it.
"As long ago as that?"
She answered, as if the date had long been fixed for her.
"The first time was at Shadow Pond."
"Was that why you gave me my coffee before the others?"
"I don't know. Did I? I was dreadfully put out when you wouldn't go to the picnic with me, and then, when I saw you coming down the road, I thought maybe you'd gone home that way on purpose, and that made me glad."
They were silent again. They had reached a point where the road dipped to the hollow by Ethan's mill, and as they descended, the darkness descended with them, dropping down like a black veil from the heavy hemlock boughs.
"I'm tied, hand and foot, Matt. There isn't a thing I can do," he began again.
"You must write to me sometimes, Ethan."
"What good'll writing do? I want to put my hand out and touch you. I want to do for you and care for you. I want to be there when you're sick and when you're lonesome."
"You mustn't think but what I'll do all right."
"You won't need me, you mean. I suppose you'll marry."
"Oh, Ethan," she cried.
"I don't know how it is you make me feel, Matt. I'd almost rather have you dead than that."
"Oh, I wish I was. I wish I was," she sobbed.
The sound of her weeping shook him out of his dark anger, and he felt ashamed.
"Don't let's talk that way," he whispered.
"Why shouldn't we, when it's true? I've been wishing it every minute of the day."
"Matt, you be quiet. Don't you say it.
There's never anybody been good to me but you."
"Don't say that either, when I can't lift a hand for you."
"Yes, but it's true, just the same."
They had reached the top of Schoolhouse Hill, and Starkfield lay below them in the twilight. A cutter, mounting the road from the village, passed them by in a joyous flutter of bells, and they straightened themselves and looked ahead with rigid faces. Along the main street, lights had begun to shine from the house fronts, and stray figures were turning in here and there at the gates. Ethan, with a touch of his whip, roused the sorrel to a languid trot. As they drew near the end of the village, the cries of children reached them, and they saw a knot of boys, with sleds behind them, scattering across the open space before the church.
"I guess this'll be their last coast for a day or two," Ethan said, looking up at the mild sky.
Matty was silent, and he added,
"We were to have gone down last night."
Still she did not speak, and, prompted by an obscure desire to help himself and her through their miserable last hour, he went on discursively,
"Ain't it funny we haven't been down together but just that once last winter?"
She answered,
"It wasn't often I got down to the village."
"That's so," he said.
They had reached the crest of the Corbury Road, and between the indistinct white glimmer of the church and the black curtain of the Varnum spruces, the slope stretched away below them, without a sled on its length. Some erratic impulse prompted Ethan to say,
"How'd you like me to take you down now?"
She forced a laugh.
Why, there isn't time."
"There's all the time we want. Come along."
His one desire now was to postpone the moment of turning the sorrel toward the flats.
"But the girl," she faltered,
"the girl'll be waiting at the station."
"Well, let her wait. You'd have to if she didn't. Come."
The note of authority in his voice seemed to subdue her, and when he had jumped from the sleigh, she let him help her out, saying only with a vague faint of reluctance,
"But there isn't a sled round anywheres."
"Yes, there is, right over there under the spruces."
He threw the bearskin over the sorrel, who stood passively by the roadside, hanging a meditative head. Then he caught Mattie's hand and drew her after him toward the sled. She seated herself obediently, and he took his place behind her, so close that her hair brushed his face.
"All right, Matt," he called out, as if the width of the road had been between them.
She turned her head to say,
"It's dreadfully dark. Are you sure you can see?"
He laughed contemptuously.
"I could go down this coast with my eyes tied."
And she laughed with him, as if she liked his audacity. Nevertheless, he sat still a moment, straining his eyes down the long hill, for it was the most confusing hour of the evening, the hour when the last clearness from the upper sky is merged with a rising night and a blur that disguises landmarks and falsifies distances.
"Now," he cried.
The sled started with a bound, and they flew on through the dusk, gathering smoothness and speed as they went, with the hollow night opening out below them and the air singing by like an organ. Matty sat perfectly still, but as they reached the bend at the foot of the hill, where the big elm thrust out a deadly elbow, he fancied that she shrank a little closer.
"Don't be scared, Matt," he cried exultantly,
as they spun safely past it and flew down the second slope. And when they reached the level ground beyond, and the speed of the sled began to slacken, he heard her give a little laugh of glee. They sprang off and started to walk back up the hill. Ethan dragged the sled with one hand and passed the other through Matty's arm.
"Were you scared I'd run you into the elm?"
he asked with a boyish laugh.
"I told you I was never scared with you," she answered.
The strange exaltation of his mood had brought on one of his rare fits of boastfulness.
"It's a tricky place, though. The least swerve, and we'd never a come up again. But I can measure distances to a hair's breadth. Always could."
She murmured, "I always say you've got the surest eye." Deep silence had fallen with the starless dusk, and they leaned on each other without speaking. But at every step of their climb, Ethan said to himself, "It's the last time we'll ever walk together." They mounted slowly to the top of the hill. When they were abreast of the church, he stooped his head to her to ask,
"Are you tired?"
And she answered, breathing quickly,
"It was splendid."
With a pressure of his arm, he guided her toward the Norway spruces.
"I guess this sled must be Ned Hale's. Anyway, I'll leave it where I found it."
He drew the sled up to the Varnum gate and rested it against the fence. As he raised himself, he suddenly felt Matty close to him among the shadows.
"Is this where Ned and Ruth kissed each other?"
she whispered breathlessly, and flung her arms about him. Her lips, groping for his, swept over his face, and he held her fast in a rapture of surprise.
"Goodbye, goodbye," she stammered, and kissed him again. "Oh, Matt, I can't let you go,"
broke from him in the same old cry. She freed herself from his hold, and he heard her sobbing.
"Oh, I can't go either," she wailed. "Matt, what'll we do? What'll we do?"
They clung to each other's hands like children, and her body shook with desperate sobs. Through the stillness they heard the church clock striking 5.
"Oh, Ethan, it's time," she cried.
He drew her back to him.
"Time for what? You don't suppose I'm going to leave you now? If I missed my train, where'd I go?" "Where are you going if you catch it?"
She stood silent, her hands lying cold and relaxed in his.
"What's the good of either of us going anywheres without the other one now?"
he said. She remained motionless, as if she had not heard him. Then she snatched her hands from his, threw her arms about his neck, and pressed a sudden drenched cheek against his face.
"Ethan! Ethan! I want you to take me down again."
"Down where?"
"The coast. Right off," she panted, "so that we'll never come up any more." "Matt, what on earth do you mean?"
She put her lips close against his ear to say,
"Right into the big elm. You said you could, so that we never have to leave each other any more."
"Why, what are you talking of? You're crazy."
"I'm not crazy. But I will be if I leave you."
"Oh, Matt, Matt," he groaned. She tightened her fierce hold about his neck, Her face lay close to his face.
"Ethan, where will I go if I leave you? I don't know how to get along alone. You said so yourself just now. Nobody but you was ever good to me. And there'll be that strange girl in the house, and she'll sleep in my bed, where I used to lay nights and listen to hear you come up the stairs."
The words were like fragments torn from his heart. With them came the hated vision of the house he was going back to, of the stairs he would have to go up every night, of the woman who would wait for him there. And the sweetness of Mattie's avowal, the wild wonder of knowing at last that all that had happened to him had happened to her too, made the other vision more abhorrent, the other life more intolerable to return to. Her pleadings still came to him between short sobs, but he no longer heard what she was saying. Her hat had slipped back, and he was stroking her hair. He wanted to get the feeling of it into his hand, so that it would sleep there like a seed in winter. Once he found her mouth again, and they seemed to be by the pond together in the burning August sun, but his cheek touched hers, and it was cold and full of weeping, and he saw the road to the flats under the night, and heard the whistle of the train up the line. The spruces swathed them in blackness and silence. They might have been in their coffins underground. He said to himself, "Perhaps it'll feel like this." And then again, "After this, I shan't feel anything." Suddenly, he heard the old sorrel whinny across the road, and thought, "He's wondering why he doesn't get his supper."
"Come,"
Mattie whispered, tugging at his hand. Her somber violence constrained him. She seemed the embodied instrument of fate. He pulled the sled out, blinking like a night bird as he passed from the shade of the spruces into the transparent dusk of the open. The slope below them was deserted. All Starkfield was at supper, and not a figure crossed the open space before the church. The sky, swollen with the clouds that announce a thaw, hung as low as before a summer storm. He strained his eyes through the dimness, and they seemed less keen, less capable than usual. He took his seat on the sled, and Mattie instantly placed herself in front of him. Her hat had fallen into the snow, and his lips were in her hair. He stretched out his legs, drove his heels into the road to keep the sled from slipping forward, and bent her head back between his hands. Then, suddenly, he sprang up again. "Get up," he ordered. It was the tone she always heeded, but she cowered down in her seat, repeating vehemently,
"No, no, no."
"Get up."
"Why?"
"I want to sit in front."
"No, no. How can you steer in front?"
"I don't have to. We'll follow the track." They spoke in smothered whispers, as though the night were listening. "Get up. Get up," he urged her, but she kept on repeating,
"Why do you want to sit in front?"
Because I want to feel you holding me," he stammered, and dragged her to her feet. The answer seemed to satisfy her, or else she yielded to the power of his voice. He bent down, feeling in the obscurity for the glassy slide worn by preceding coasters, and placed the runners carefully between its edges. She waited while he seated himself with crossed legs in the front of the sled. Then she crouched quickly down at his back, and clasped her arms about him. Her breath in his neck set him shuddering again, and he almost sprang from his seat. But in a flash he remembered the alternative. She was right. This was better than parting. He leaned back and drew her mouth to his. Just as they started, he heard the sorrel's whinny again, and the familiar wistful call and all the confused images it brought with it went with him down the first reach of the road. Halfway down there was a sudden drop, then a rise, and after that another long delirious descent. As they took wing for this, it seemed to him that they were flying indeed, flying far up into the cloudy night, with Starkfield immeasurably below them, falling away like a speck in space. Then the big elm shot up ahead, lying in wait for them at the bend of the road, and he said between his teeth, "We can fetch it. I know we can fetch it." As they flew toward the tree, Matty pressed her arms tighter, and her blood seemed to be in his veins. Once or twice the sled swerved a little under them. He slanted his body to keep it headed for the elm, repeating to himself again and again, "I know we can fetch it." And little phrases she had spoken ran through his head and danced before him on the air. The big tree loomed bigger and closer, and as they bore down on it, he thought, "It's waiting for us. It seems to know." But suddenly his wife's face, with twisted monstrous lineaments, thrust itself between him and his goal, and he made an instinctive movement to brush it aside. The sled swerved in response, but he righted again, kept it straight, and drove down on the black projecting mass. There was a last instant when the air shot past him like millions of fiery wires, and then the elm. The sky was still thick, but looking straight up he saw a single star, and tried vaguely to reckon whether it was Sirius or the effort tired him too much, and he closed his heavy lids and thought that he would sleep. The stillness was so profound that he heard a little animal twittering somewhere nearby under the snow. It made a small frightened cheep like a field mouse, and he wondered languidly if it were hurt. Then he understood that it must be in pain, pain so excruciating that he seemed mysteriously to feel it shooting through his body. He tried in vain to roll over in the direction of the sound, and stretched his left arm out across the snow. And now it was as though he felt rather than heard the twittering. It seemed to be under his palm, which rested on something soft and springy. The thought of the animal's suffering was intolerable to him, and he struggled to raise himself, and could not because a rock or some huge mass seemed to be lying on him. But he continued to finger about cautiously with his left hand, thinking he might get hold of the little creature and help it. And all at once he knew that the soft thing he had touched was Mattie's hair, and that his hand was on her face. He dragged himself to his knees, the monstrous load on him moving with him as he moved, and his hand went over and over her face, and he felt that the twittering came from her lips. He got his face down close to hers, with his ear to her mouth, and in the darkness he saw her eyes open, and heard her say his name. "Oh, Matt, I thought we'd fetched it," he moaned. And far off, up the hill, he heard the sorrel whinny, and thought, "I ought to be getting him his feed."
The querulous drone ceased as I entered Frome's kitchen, and of the two women sitting there, I could not tell which had been the speaker. One of them, on my appearing, raised her tall, bony figure from her seat, not as if to welcome me, for she threw me no more than a brief glance of surprise, but simply to set about preparing the meal which Frome's absence had delayed. A slatternly calico wrapper hung from her shoulders, and the wisps of her thinned gray hair were drawn away from a high forehead and fastened at the back by a broken comb. She had pale, opaque eyes, which revealed nothing and reflected nothing, and her narrow lips were of the same sallow color as her face. The other woman was much smaller and slighter. She sat huddled in an armchair near the stove, and when I came in she moved her head quickly toward me, without the least corresponding movement of her body. Her hair was as gray as her companion's,
her face as bloodless and shriveled, but amber-tinted, with swarthy shadows sharpening the nose and hollowing the temples. Under her shapeless dress, her body kept its limp immobility, and her dark eyes had the bright witch-like stare that disease of the spine sometimes gives. Even for that part of the country, the kitchen was a poor-looking place, with the exception of the dark-eyed woman's chair, which looked like a soiled relic of luxury bought at a country auction. The furniture was of the roughest kind. Three coarse china plates and a broken-nosed milk-jug had been set on a greasy table scored with knife-cuts, and a couple of straw-bottomed chairs and a kitchen dresser of unpainted pine stood meagerly against the plaster walls.
"My, it's cold here. The fire must be most out,"
Frome said, glancing about him apologetically as he followed me in. The tall woman, who had moved away from us toward the dresser, took no notice, but the other, from her cushioned niche, answered complainingly in a thin, high voice,
"It's only just been made up this very minute. Zina fell asleep, and slept ever so long, and I thought I'd be frozen stiff before I could wake her up and get her to tend to it."
I knew then it was she who had been speaking when we entered. Her companion, who was just coming back to the table with the remains of a cold mince pie and a battered pie-dish, sat down her unappetizing burden without appearing to hear the accusation brought against her. Frome stood hesitatingly before her as she advanced. Then he looked at me and said,
"This is my wife, Miss Frome."
After another interval, he added, turning toward the figure in the armchair,
"And this is Miss Mattie Silver."
Mrs. Hale, tender soul, had pictured me as lost in the flat and buried under a snowdrift, and so lively was her satisfaction on seeing me safely restored to her the next morning that I felt my peril had caused me to advance several degrees in her favor. Great was her amazement, and that of old Mrs. Varnum, on learning that Ethan Frome's old horse had carried me to and from Corbury Junction, through the worst blizzard of the winter. Greater still their surprise when they heard that his master had taken me in for the night. Beneath their wondering exclamations, I felt a secret curiosity to know what impressions I had received from my night in the Frome household, and divined that the best way of breaking down their reserve was to let them try to penetrate mine. I therefore confined myself to saying, in a matter-of-fact tone, that I had been received with great kindness, and that Frome had made a bed for me in a room on the ground floor, which seemed in happier days to have been fitted up as a kind of writing-room or study.
"Well," Mrs. Hale mused, "in such a storm, I suppose, he felt he couldn't do less than take you in. But I guess it went hard with Ethan. I don't believe but what you're the only stranger has set foot in that house for over 20 years. He's that proud he don't even like his oldest friends to go there, and I don't know as any do any more, except myself and the doctor."
"You still go there, Mrs. Hale?" I ventured.
"Oh, I used to go a good deal after the accident, when I was first married. But after a while I got to think it made him feel worse to see us. And then one thing and another came, and my own troubles. But I generally make out to drive over there round New Year's, and once in the summer. Only I always try to pick a day when Ethan's off somewheres. It's bad enough to see the two women sitting there. But his face, when he looks round that bare place, just kills me. You see, I can look back and call it up in his mother's day, before their troubles."
Old Mrs. Varnum by this time had gone up to bed, and her daughter and I were sitting alone after supper in the austere seclusion of the horsehair parlor. Mrs. Hale glanced at me tentatively, as though trying to see how much footing my conjectures gave her, and I guessed that if she had kept silence till now, it was because she had been waiting, through all the years, for someone who should see what she alone had seen. I waited to let her trust in me gather strength before I said, "Yes, it's pretty bad, seeing all three of them there together." She drew her mild brows into a frown of pain.
"It was just awful from the beginning. I was here in the house when they were carried up. They laid Mattie Silver in the room you're in. She and I were great friends, and she was to have been my bridesmaid in the spring. And when she came to, I went up to her and stayed all night. They gave her things to quiet her, and she didn't know much till toward morning. And then, all of a sudden, she woke up just like herself, and looked straight at me out of her big eyes, and said, 'Oh, I don't know why I'm telling you all this.'" Mrs. Hale broke off, crying. She took off her spectacles, wiped the moisture from them, and put them on again with an unsteady hand. "It got about the next day," she went on, "that Zina Frum had sent Mattie off in a hurry because she had a hired girl coming, and the folks here could never rightly tell what she and Ethan were doing that night coasting, when they'd thought to have been on their way to the flats to catch the train. I never knew what Zina thought. I don't to this day. Nobody knows Zina's thoughts. Anyhow, when she heard of the accident, she came right in and stayed with Ethan over to the minister's, where they'd carried him. And as soon as the doctor said that Mattie could be moved, Zina sent for her and took her back to the farm. And there she's been ever since?" Mrs. Hale answered simply, "There was nowhere else for her to go." And my heart tightened at the thought of the hard compulsions of the poor. "Yes, there she's been," Mrs. Hale continued, "and Zina's done for her and done for Ethan as good as she could. It was a miracle, considering how sick she was, but she seemed to be raised right up just when the call came to her. Not that she's ever given up doctoring, and she's had sick spells right along, but she's had the strength given to her to care for those two for over 20 years. And before the accident came, she thought she couldn't even care for herself." Mrs. Hale paused a moment, and I remained silent, plunged in the vision of what her words evoked. "It's horrible for them all," I murmured. "Yes, it's pretty bad. And they ain't any of 'em easy people, either. Mattie was, before the accident. I never knew a sweeter nature. But she's suffered too much. That's what I always say when folks tell me how she's soured. And Zina, she was always cranky. Not but what she bears with Mattie wonderful. I've seen that myself. But sometimes the two of 'em would get going at each other, and then Ethan's face would break your heart. When I see that, I think it's him that suffers most. Anyhow, it ain't Zina, because she ain't got the time. It's a pity, though," Mrs. Hale ended, sighing, "that they're all shut up there in that one kitchen. In the summertime, on pleasant days, they move Mattie into the parlor, or out in the dooryard, and that makes it easier. But winters, there's the fires to be thought of, and there ain't a dime to spare up at the Frooms'." Mrs. Hale drew a deep breath, as though her memory were eased of its long burden, and she had no more to say. But suddenly an impulse of complete avowal seized her. She took off her spectacles again, leaned toward me against the beadwork table cover, and went on with a lowered voice. "There was one day, about a week after the accident, when they all thought Mattie couldn't live. Well, I say it's a pity she did. I said it right out to our minister once, and he was shocked at me. Only he wasn't with me that morning when she first came to. And I say, if she had a died, Ethan might have lived. And the way they are now, I don't see there's much difference between the Frooms up at the farm and the Frooms down in the graveyard. Except down there they're all quiet, and the women have got to hold their tongues." End of chapter 9.
End of Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.